mostly dedicated to really extensive reporting on local public meetings and political events, school board, which is increasingly of no interest to online publications, we've discovered.
Okay, let's go ahead.
Excellent. So I understand that you're in town actually for two different talks.
Yes, three actually. It was a seminar yesterday and a talk. And,
okay.
Another one today.
Okay. And yesterday was with linguistics and today is with Leo Geo.
Yeah.
Okay. How did yesterday go?
Fine as always. It's a very good department here, and there's a national meeting of the Linguistic Society, so lots of people.
Okay. Did you primarily
plenty of old students?
Of yours?
Yeah. It was nice.
That must be really wonderful.
Yeah. In fact, a lot of retiring already, which is strange.
Plausibly terrifying.
Yeah.
Did you primarily come for the linguistics piece or to speak to the union?
I was first invited by the linguists. That goes way back.
Okay.
I have pretty close connections with the linguistics department.
And so the substance of that talk, well, I was looking at the abstract online, where you mentioned this traditional view that the purpose of language is to construct thoughts, and the more contemporary view that its principal use is communication. I was hoping you could elucidate that a little further.
Well, by now it's a kind of a dogma that the function of language is primarily communication. Mm-hmm. There's no support for it, and there's actually pretty strong evidence against it, and I ran through some of the evidence yesterday.
Okay.
The most important evidence is actually just when you take a look at the actual nature of language.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what you find is that, you have to really look closely, but you have to find that there are conflicts between what's called computational efficiency, getting the best possible system,
mm-hmm.
which is the way a language would develop, just in the mind and seeks the best possible system. There are conflicts between that and communicative efficiency, what's good for communication. And when you investigate those conflicts, you find that invariably, as far as is known, computational efficiency wins out, and communication is simply ignored. The most striking example, and the one that I did talk about a little, has to do with just the linear order of words. That's essential for communication, of course, but it doesn't seem to be even part of the structure of the language. It seems to be in something tacked on the outside just to meet the conditions of the sensory motor system, but not part of the language fundamentally.
So you're saying that the fact that it's linear, that we speak in a stream of words.
It's because we can't speak in parallel. That's the nature of our sensory motor system. If we had two channels and could speak in parallel, which incidentally dolphins do, we could have a more complex system. But whatever's going on in the brain has to be, if it does come out, has to come out through the sensory motor system, through touch or sight or usually sound. And incidentally, very little of it comes out. So if you just introspect for a minute, you'll discover that you can't go 30 seconds without talking to yourself. It's almost impossible. And 99% of your use of language never even is externalized.
That's really wonderful and stunning.
Well, just think about it.
Yeah.
It takes a real act of will to keep from talking to yourself.
So when you're talking about what's the edge of language for you? Because we do things that are communicative that you probably aren't grouping into language. Like we've made choices in the garments that we've worn in part to communicate certain things about
Yeah,
our sound.
Almost everything we do is some form of communication.
But when you're talking about language, you're taking a subset.
Language is also used for communication and for many other things.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for whatever reason, humans find it difficult and hard to be in the same place with somebody and not to talk to them. I mean, if you're standing at a bus stop for half an hour,
mm-hmm.
the chances are you'll talk to the person next to you.
I have a 7-year-old son, so I understand.
Well, it's just really hard. Mm-hmm. If you're stuck in a room with somebody, it's a way of torturing people.
Mm-hmm.
Put two people in a room, close the door, and ask them not to talk to each other. I mean, it just doesn't work. You have to do it. And that kind of interaction is not serious communication. So if you're talking to somebody at a bus stop, and you talk about what happened to the football team yesterday or something, you don't care. They don't care. You're not trying to transmit any information. It's what anthropologists sometimes call phatic communication, just setting up relations among people. And most interchange with language is actually that. You're telling jokes at a party or something, you're not communicating anything. This is just a way of creating and solidifying social relations. If communication means anything, we can deprive it of meaning if we like.
Mm-hmm.
But if it means something, it has something to do with transmitting beliefs, information, something like that. And that's a very marginal aspect of language, or wearing clothes, for example. You're communicating in other ways.
Mm-hmm.
But even that is, plus the fact that very little of language is even externalized, that isn't really as significant as what's more difficult to think about, but much more important. What's the fundamental design of language? If you want to understand, say, what the function of the visual system is, you can't just say, I use it to watch television. That's not biology.
Mm-hmm.
You want to understand the function of the visual system, you have to look into its nature, see what it does, investigate it. It's a scientific problem. And then you find things about the visual system that are surprising. And it's the same with language. It's not enough to say, yeah, I use it to talk to my friends. If you want to understand something about it, you have to look into its nature. And you can't do that in a casual conversation. That requires investigation, like any other hard topic. And when you investigate it, you find things like what I just mentioned, that linear order just isn't part of the way language is used. You can see it in simple cases.
Mm-hmm.
So take the example I used last night. Take this sentence, eagles that fly swim, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And put an adverb in front of it. Instinctively, eagles that fly swim. What does it, instinctively goes with the verb.
Mm-hmm.
Which verb? It goes with swim, with fly. So it's instinctively they swim, not instinctively they fly. Well, fly is the verb that's closest to instinctively, but you never use linear order.
Mm-hmm.
You never use closeness to determine how things are understood. Or suppose you put can in front of it. Can eagles that fly swim? You're asking a question about swimming, not flying,
mm-hmm.
even though swimming is farther away. And in fact, there is a minimal distance relation between instinctively and can and swim, but it's a structural relation. That requires looking into the nature of structure. Then you find, yes, it's a minimal distance, but a minimal structural distance, not a minimal linear distance. Now, calculating linear distances is far simpler than calculating structural differences. If you look at the...
Turn up the lights a little
for you. Oh, that's okay. You look at the computational properties, calculating order is trivial. Calculating structure is quite difficult. And nevertheless, you just automatically, reflexively calculate structure. A child, for example, never makes a mistake about this. Children have no evidence, but they have zero evidence about what the adverb goes with. But every infant understands it. And it's because the nature of it, and this is not just this example, but every example, every construction in every language works the same way. It uses complex, computationally complex notions like structural distance, but not computationally simple notions like linear distance. And that cannot, there's only one possible explanation for that. A linear order just isn't available for the computational system. It's just not available, period. Therefore, you can't use it. And you use the simplest thing there is, which is structural distance. But that tells you that linear order just comes from somewhere else, not from the language. And it's obvious where it comes from. You can't speak in parallel. You can't speak structurally. You can't produce structures. You can only produce linear orders of words. So you're forced, whatever's going on in the mind has to work its way through this system on the outside, the sensory motor system. If you look at the evolution of, we know very little about the evolution of these things, but something. The sensory motor system was around for millennia, centuries before the language ever emerged. So it was just sitting there. For example, chimpanzees have approximately the same auditory system we have. We don't have any problem detecting the sounds that we detect. But it's just noise to them. They can't do it. They're not designed to do it. So take, say, a newborn infant. There's all kind of noise going on in the environment, massive stimuli. What William James called the blooming, buzzing confusion. That's what the child's born into. But an infant reflexively extracts from that environment certain things that are language related. An ape just hears noise. Similarly, humans can't detect what other animals pick out of the environment. We're not built for it. They're not built for language. We're built for language. Infant picks it out reflexively and virtually reflexively goes through the stages of development that lead to what you and I are now doing. Very little teaching. It's called learning, but it doesn't mean anything. It's just a system that grows. And it's like other biological systems. It's internally designed. And you have to, when you study its nature, which is, you know, takes some work, you discover that, for example, things like linear order just aren't part of it. That's a deep fundamental property of language, and it indicates that any form of externalization, getting it into the outside world, is tacked on, it's secondary, and therefore any use of that is even more remote from the nature of language, like communication, for example.
Let me step back. Why is it that we know, or we're led to believe, that externalization is an afterthought rather than fundamental?
Because it's not part. Externalization requires linear order, and linear order is not part of the computational system, so therefore it's tacked on afterwards. And the only obvious reason is because whatever's going on in our minds has to work its way through the sensory motor system to get outside.
So there's...
And the sensory motor system imposes constraints, mm-hmm. which have nothing to do with language.
I have bifurcating questions now, predictably.
Pardon?
I have bifurcating questions.
Yeah.
I guess one, just about linguistics, is I get the sense that you kind of feel like linguistics has gone off into the weeds. There's too much interest in communication and not enough into the fundamental process that's generating language.
Actually, there isn't very much interest in communication. This is a dogma, but nobody really investigates it. So nobody studied much about communication. And there's a good reason for that. Communication, if you really are interested in communication, you're studying a process of extreme complexity.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if when you and I do try to communicate, like what we're doing now, we're bringing in all kinds of background assumptions about each other, which we're not aware of, but they're critical to the interchange that's going on. And they come from all over the place. I mean, the way we look, my guesses about your background, your guesses about my background, an enormous, complex background of implicit understanding, partial understanding and assumptions is involved in the simplest act of communication. And that's just too hard to study. Scientists can't study complicated things. They can only study simple things.
Are you saying they're not up to the challenge, or it simply cannot be broken down?
It's just too hard. Science, I don't know if you have any background in the sciences, but it's hard. If a molecule becomes too complicated, mm-hmm. say helium, it's very complicated, the physicists can't study it anymore. They have to hand it over to chemists who look at more complicated things. If an organic molecule or an organic system becomes too complicated, the chemists can't handle it. They give it to the biologists. They try to do something with it. If it's too complicated for the biologists, like what we're now talking about, mm-hmm. they hand it over to social scientists. They try to do something with it. And the farther, the more you get into more and more complexity, the less and less you're able to discover. Just for obvious reasons. It's hard to study complicated things. It's hard enough to study simple things, seriously. So for example, the physicists can't really solve what's called the three-body problem, mm-hmm. how do three bodies interact. It's just too hard.
So then your inclination is to believe that looking at the generative mechanism of language probably would mean that there's a simplification going on there, that there's a few core principles or functions.
There's something obvious about language.
Mm-hmm.
Every language, yours, mine, everyone, provides an unbounded array of potential expressions that could be thought and could be used. And it's unbounded, it's infinite. You can keep adding new ones without bounds, kind of like the numbers. There's always a bigger one. And it's got to be a finite system because you've got a finite brain. So there's a finite system which is yielding, generating, is the technical term, an infinite array of potential expressions. Each of them is a structured object which has some kind of meaning, semantic interpretation connected to thoughts. And sometimes it's externalized into the outside world, rarely, but sometimes. That's the core property of language. Now, it wasn't really possible to study that property seriously until about 60 years ago. And the reason was that the fundamental concept of a finite system yielding an infinite array of structures was not very well understood. That's why if you go back to, say, Darwin, mm-hmm. He describes the fundamental difference between humans and all other animals is language. And language provides, he says, an almost infinite number of expressions. Well, the phrase almost infinite doesn't mean anything. That's like saying there is an almost infinite number of integers.
Mm-hmm.
It's not almost infinite, it's infinite.
Mm-hmm.
You can't be almost infinite. But the concept was not understood, so the standard traditional term used by a lot of people was mm-hmm. almost infinite. It didn't mean anything. What it means is infinite, but the brain is finite, so you have the problem of understanding how a finite object, like say your laptop computer or your brain, which is a finite object, can, given enough time and memory, go on indefinitely. You can write a program for your laptop which will add any numbers, no matter how big they are.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, for the laptop to do that, you might have to stick in extra disks because it doesn't have enough memory. But it has the program, the system, which can do it. And that array, range of concepts was not really fully understood until roughly the 1930s. By then, the fundamental nature of computational systems was clarified and discovered, and it became possible to pursue these questions in a much more serious way than before. There were stabs at them in the past, but it could only be stabs of the basic understanding of such systems made it possible to look at the core property of language, the basic property, the one that I just mentioned. But when you do it, it's not easy. It's like other problems in the sciences. It sounds easy, but it isn't. Actually, I mentioned yesterday that what started to happen roughly in the 1950s is a little bit like what happened in the basic sciences in the early 17th century. You go back to the history of science. For millennia, the greatest scientists thought they had answers, like Aristotle, to Galileo, thought they had answers to very simple questions. Like, suppose I have a cup in my hand that has boiling water in it, and I have my hand over the cup. If I let go of it with my hands, the cup will fall and the steam will rise. Why? Well, there was an answer. They're each finding their natural place. The natural place of steam is up there. Natural place. The cup is down there. Okay, end of problem. If I have two cups, or say two objects, a big heavy one and a little light one and a big heavy one, and I drop them, which will fall faster? Well, obviously the heavy. And that was, if I look at that rectangle over there, mm-hmm. how do I see it? Well, its form mm-hmm. flits through the air and imprints itself in my brain. It solves that problem. And there were answers like that to problems, except that none of them made any sense.
Mm-hmm.
And when around the time of Galileo and others, early 17th century, when scientists began to allow themselves to be puzzled about these things, not to be satisfied with what are really meaningless answers, and then you get the beginning of science. And it turns out all your intuitions are wrong, all your guesses are wrong, all your beliefs are senseless, and you enter into the rational spirit, which became the Enlightenment and became the modern era. That's not that there was nothing there before. Of course, there was a lot there before. But there was a big change then. And that's the same kind of change that, in my opinion, this is a minority opinion, ought to take place in the human sciences and can in some areas. The study of language is one of them. The study of vision is another. In fact, if you go back, say, 60 years,
mm-hmm.
it was quite commonly assumed among biologists that the variety of organisms was, the same phrase was used, almost infinite. Well, either infinite or
mm-hmm.
fixed. There's no almost infinite. But and that was a common belief. I'm actually paraphrasing a mm-hmm. famous biologist. And it turns out to be completely wrong. The range of organisms is very narrow. So narrow that there are even proposals, which may be wrong, but are taken seriously, that there's what's called a universal genome, a basic genome for metazoa, complex
mm-hmm.
organisms, that is essentially fixed and emerged at around the Cambrian explosion, it's called.
Mm-hmm.
And ever since then, we just get slight variations on it. Like microbacteria in humans, slight variations on this basic pattern, which was fixed. And that's, may not be right, but it doesn't seem crazy. And it's not kind of an infinite variety. And the same is true of the language and other systems. And it's now something's beginning to be understood about it. But to a large extent, it hasn't penetrated into the human sciences. This ability just to be puzzled,
mm-hmm.
just that, Galileo's ability, that's it's a hard barrier to overcome. The case that you brought up at first about the communication, linear orders, case in point.
Mm-hmm.
People ought to be puzzled about the fact that in the simple sentences I mentioned, you interpret them one way and not another way, automatically. You don't have any choice. It's just the way your mind works. And then if you're puzzled, the answer is why, the question is why, and there's an immediate answer, and it's the only answer. The computational system just doesn't pay attention to externalization, hence to communication. That's something that's tacked on the outside.
I notice that you keep using words like built and designed and tacked on, and I'm wondering if that's a metaphorical
habit.
That's
a metaphor.
Okay.
It just turned, it's like it's saying that's the way it turned out by the laws of nature.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody's designing it.
So then your inclination would be to believe that language developed among the specific species because it did, and once it started popping out of our mouths and hands, we had use for it.
There was actually use for it before it popped out, you could think.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have any tape recordings from 100,000 years ago, but you try to reconstruct what must have happened, very likely happened. We were proto-humans were hunter-gatherers. In fact, humans were hunter-gatherers until very recently. That's practically the whole history of Homo sapiens.
Mm-hmm.
And there were small groups, maybe 50, 100 people. And evidently, in one of these groups, probably very small rewiring of the brain took place by some small genetic change. Not enough is understood about genetics to imagine what it could be. But things like that do happen. Plenty of evidence for them. And so some small genetic change took place. It yielded the capacity to produce and to meet the basic property of language, produce this infinite array of expressions that latched on to thought systems that were kind of inchoate,
mm-hmm.
limited, restricted, maybe shared with other animals. And at that point, you have the ability to plan, to interpret, to think, gives you advantages. Can't communicate because nobody else has it. This happens in a person.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have mutations in a group.
Mm-hmm.
You're in individuals. It would probably die out. Most advantageous mutations do die out. It's hard for them to latch on. There's statistical evidence for that now. But this one apparently latched on. It transmitted to offspring, partially. After a while, it could take over a small group. At that point, there becomes a reason to externalize it.
Mm-hmm.
Externalizing it is a hard problem. You have to connect this thing that's inside your mind, which developed without any selectional pressures at all, just by laws of nature. You have to connect that to a sensory motor system that had been around for hundreds of thousands of years. And they don't match. They're different systems. So it's a hard problem. And that's the problem of externalization. When you learn a second language, suppose you learn French, French is going to have the same property about the linear order that I mentioned
mm-hmm.
in English, but you don't learn that. Nobody teaches it to you. You know it, because that's part of your being human, to know that. What you have to learn is what amount to trivialities, how it's pronounced, what's the order of the words, what kind of affixes does it have, you memorize inflections. What you learn when you learn a second language are a selection of trivialities that are around the periphery of the language. But the core part of the language you don't learn, because that's just the nature of humans. And same with a child acquiring the language. And that's the externalization problem. And it's a hard problem, so it can be done in many different ways, and we get the kind of illusion that there are many different languages, fundamentally all the same. And that's how we can learn any of them. A child can learn any of them, because basically they're the core computational processes, they're probably identical, very similar, with variations in almost entirely the externalization system.
You had mentioned the anguish people feel if they're in proximity and denied the ability to communicate, or obviously if they're isolated and unable to communicate.
To interact.
To
which is quite different from communicating.
To interact with another, yeah. Or with their sense of another person or entity.
Just to have some relation to that other person there.
Would you, I'm asking you to guess, I suppose, that came with that original creation of language device that only arose after people started?
That's animals. I mean, there are a lot of things like that. Mm-hmm. For example, it's very, you can't look into somebody else's eyes for more than a fleeting second. If you do, it's either hostile or very intimate. It can't just be ordinary. Like you and I can't look into each other's eyes for more than a second. It would be very hostile.
Mm-hmm.
Or else it would mean we're love or something like that. There's nothing in between. That's just part of being human. Other animals find it very hostile.
Mm-hmm.
Like sometimes you just can't stare at an animal that'll get angry. You know? Why? Well, that's got nothing to do with language. That's something deep in the history of organisms. Nobody knows why.
So that's just an aspect that's, like the sensory motor system has become very tightly linked to this, but is sort of a separate...
It's got its own characteristics, which were there long before language. Mm-hmm. As I said, the auditory system is probably common primate, pretty close to it. I mean, there's even evidence that chimpanzees pick out the same sounds that humans pick out. You don't use all the possible sounds for language, only mm-hmm. some of them. And it seems that apes are pretty much tuned to the same sounds. Of course, they can't do anything with them. For them, it's just noise.
So, are there questions being asked and investigated in linguistics right now that you find very interesting, or is it...
Oh, yeah. All of these, for example. And this is just the beginning. They okay. go on and find a lot of other things. In fact, almost everything you look at is puzzling. It was just like physics in the 17th century. Once physicists allowed themselves to be puzzled, everything became a puzzle, because you understand nothing. You know, in fact, Galileo, at the end of his life, kind of commiserated that he understands, I forget exactly how he put it, but he said, we can understand nothing about the world, nothing. You know? And what he meant is, we can't give an explanation for it in terms that are intelligible.
So we're blinded by all the things we think we know.
We know in some sense. Like, I know that if I let the cup go, it'll fall.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody's telling me that. I know it. Why does it fall? Well, it turns out to be not so trivial when you look into it. How fast does it fall? Do two things of different weights fall at different speeds?
Mm-hmm.
That's the bare beginning already. By that point, your intuitions are all wrong. When you go on to more complicated things, they get even more wrong. And that's rational inquiry. That's science.
Man, I don't know which question to go with next. Are there things that you would like to talk about in these situations but never get a chance to because you're asked a limited set of questions?
Well, you know, the really interesting questions, if we went on, would require a blackboard, you know, a lecture. I mean, that's why people go to graduate school
mm-hmm.
or undergraduate. You can't just talk about it. I mean, you can talk about simple cases, but as soon as you look into it, it becomes hard enough to go pretty soon.
Okay. Then I guess I have some writing questions. You seem to average about 2 books a year over the course of the last 50-odd years.
That's misleading. A lot of the books are collections of interviews or talks.
Well, you seem to write a fair bit, and I'd read that you used to use sort of a very idiosyncratic word processor your son had created. Do you still use that, or?
I would use it, except that Microsoft, in its wisdom, has weakened the basic core program, DOS, and by now DOS doesn't support it any longer. For years, my son was a high school student, mm-hmm. back in the early 80s, He just wrote it in machine language. There were no word processors then.
Mm-hmm.
And for the computer scientists, that's great.
Mm-hmm.
You can fiddle with it, you can do things with it. The contemporary word processing systems that good computer scientists don't like,
mm-hmm.
because what goes on is kind of hidden inside them and you can't manipulate it. And as the systems became more user-friendly, the producers, like say Microsoft, weakened the support system, and it no longer can handle the kind of system I saw, so I can't use it.
So what are you using now?
Just use some commercial
Whatever's there?
Whatever comes.
Do you have a daily habit of writing, or...?
Just whenever I get a little time.
Because you're also obviously extensively well-read and remarkably well-informed. I think a goodly portion of Ann Arbor probably looks to you to inform them about what's going on politically.
It looks different to me. What I can think of is that huge stack of books I really have to read, which I'll never get to.
Well, you're stuck like Galileo then, aren't you?
Maybe.
Yeah,
that's what we all ought to be like,
puzzled
by everything.
Yeah. When you read things that your critics have written about you politically, do you recognize yourself and how they characterize you?
Virtually never.
I was wondering, I read some pieces David Horowitz wrote around September 11th that make you sound much more terrifying than you are.
Well, what you should do when you read these things is just check back to the original sources and
mm-hmm.
see if there's anything there. Ask how it compares to what's been described. You'll notice that there rarely are references, and there's a reason for that.
Mm-hmm. One of the accusations I see leveled against you frequently is one of moral equivalency.
And moral equivalence is a very interesting concept. You know where it comes from?
Please, go on.
The term is kind of old, but
mm-hmm.
it came into common usage with Gene Kirkpatrick. Take a look at the history. Do a Google search. You'll find that until Gene Kirkpatrick, it was almost never used. With Gene Kirkpatrick, it got started.
Mm-hmm.
But what did she use it for? She used it, she was in the Reagan administration
mm-hmm.
ambassador. She used it to try to prevent criticism of the United States. So if anybody made any kind of critical comment about U.S. policy, they were accused of moral equivalence.
Mm-hmm.
Namely, equating the United States with Nazi Germany or something. It's just a crude, vulgar propaganda technique to prevent criticism of the Holy State. And no one else, that's the only way the term is ever used, like the way you used it.
Mm-hmm.
The accusation of moral equivalence means you're being critical of the Holy State. You're not allowed to be critical of the Holy State. So that's moral equivalence, whatever that's supposed to mean. But it's just a term, it's a vulgar term of propaganda, and that's where it comes from.
In that sense, you're using vulgar as in louche or vulgar as in common?
it's a cheap...
A cheap shot.
A cheap, cowardly way of protecting divinity from criticism. The divinity, in this case, is state power.
By the same note, though, people do seem frequently upset by what you write, despite the fact that what you write might be strongly worded, but is not especially strident. And I'm wondering how that strikes you.
If you were in the Soviet Union 50 years ago,
mm-hmm.
people would be very upset by what dissidents did. If you're in Iran today, critics of the government said is very really angers most of the religious population and say the rural population who support the clerics. People tend to have doctrines that they want to hold on to, and it's unpleasant to we have some share of responsibility for what the government does, and it's not easy to look into the mirror in your personal life or anything else. There's no human being who hasn't done things that are wrong. but they very rarely want to see it. What they usually do is construct some justification for it, to try to look into the mirror and see what's true. That's too simple.
Do you ever see this as a consequence of the language mechanism itself?
Not really. I think it's just it's much deeper than that.
Deeper than language?
Oh, yeah.
Which is already...
It's kind of separate from language. It's just the way... I mean, take a five-year-old kid who has a three-year-old brother, let's say, and he took a toy from his brother when his mother wasn't looking. And the little kid starts screaming, and the mother comes in and asks the older kid what happened. He says, oh, he didn't want it, you know, and it wasn't his anyway, and I just happened to have it, you know. He doesn't say, I took it from him because I'm bigger and stronger than he is, even though that was the reason. It's just normal human behavior. It's not particularly admirable, but it's normal human behavior. And it goes on to... the vulgarity of Jean Kirkpatrick. You can't criticize the Holy State, so we'll just take some, try to shut people up somehow.
Just based on what you said today, I wonder about that discomfort people feel when they are told an unpleasant truth.
About themselves.
About themselves or...
Or about anything, about anything they're associated with.
Exactly.
Like your football team or your country or whatever it may be.
And it just seems to me there's perhaps
so
an argument.
You're defensive.
Yeah, and that there's perhaps an argument to be made that if the primary thing I'm using language for is to clarify and make coherent my thoughts, when I hear someone saying back to me, it's like they're shoehorning into my head a set of unpleasant thoughts.
Yeah.
That's
what dissidence is. That's why if you take a look at history, take a look at intellectual history.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, every society... there are articulate people, you know, more privileged or whatever the reason may be.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at them, they're almost all supportive of power, supportive of power. There's almost always a fringe of dissidents, you know, a fringe of people who say that's wrong, you know. And they're almost always persecuted. And that goes back as far as you like. You go back to, say, the biblical stories, but that's... earliest kind of semi-recorded history, there were people who we would call dissidents. They were critical of the kings, they gave geopolitical analysis, you're getting us into trouble, they were calling for mercy for widows and orphans, and condemning the powerful for not doing it. Centuries later, they were honored as called prophets. They weren't honored at the time. Now take a look at what happened to them at the time. Now they were imprisoned and vilified and driven into the desert, denounced as the haters of Israel, literally, quote, and treated very badly. There were people who were treated well. Centuries later, they were called false prophets. They're the flatterers at the court. Now that's the pattern that runs right through history, right to the present. The people you were quoting, they're the flatterers at the court. The people that criticize are the ones who are picking up the mantle of the sin.
You have the advantage of a long view now. Do you think humans are rational?
They have a rational component. They have an irrational component, like all of us.
Do they exercise the rational component more than chance would dictate?
Not as much as I think they should. But, the same is true even in what are called the sciences, like, say, the things we started talking about. It seems to me, if it were rational, the kinds of things that you and I were talking about would be now truisms a teacher in elementary school. But they're very much contested, in fact, denied. If you took a poll of the people who were there last night, most of them would reject it.
Who would object to?
I suspect.
Like thinking... downplaying, thinking of communication as a almost accidental result, not as a cause.
I think they would either find it a very surprising idea or probably just reject it flat out. Except people who had studied these things.
It frankly doesn't seem that controversial.
I don't think it is.
We're only born one at a time, so. just a quick personal question. Was it frightening to be... detained and questioned in Israel, or simply inconvenient?
Boring.
Okay. It sounds terrifying to me, but I don't like going to airport security.
Well, I don't either, but it's mainly boring.
You probably have to wrap up soonish, don't you?
Yeah, I do. I really have somebody coming for me.
I was introduced to your work when I was a college student in a linguistics class, and it ended up inspiring me to write a series of computer programs that wrote poetry and then other ones that wrote self-important academic criticism of that poetry, which is just I needed to get out of the way, the kind of fanboy squealing. So if I could just ask one final question. Do colorless green ideas sleep furiously?
Well, that sentence was seriously misinterpreted, the lack of a rational faculty. As soon as the sentence came out, there were all kind of people who tried to show how you could use it, you could write a poem about it, and so on. Sure you can. You can take any sequence of words and do something with it. The point of the example was, if you look at the context, it was picked in order to refute every theory there was about what makes sense as grammatical. There's a set of ideas that were around. And that particular, it was one of a series of examples. Mm-hmm. Happens to show that they're all false. But that doesn't mean that it's not meaningful. Of course it's meaningful, so is anything. If you read the same words backwards, it's also meaningful. But it has a different status. If you say, furiously sleep ideas, green, colorless, you could write a poem about that too. But that sequence of words has a different status in your mind than colorless green ideas sleep furiously.
You know, it's really funny that it was controversial in the field, because I also used to be a high school teacher, and I would always trot this out to my classes as an English teacher. And what was remarkable to me is that people always reacted to it the same way we had when we were students, which is that you're immediately persuaded because it feels like it should make sense, but there's no way to meaningfully decode it.
On the other hand, if you read it backwards,
exactly,
it's quite different. Even though if you think about it, you can impose a meaning on it.
And so it kind of seemed, you know, QED right from the start. And it
should be trivial.
It seems to me that it's one of those cases of what people are reacting to are the bad feeling of a thought clanging in their head with the other thoughts, more than a rational.
That's true. And that's true of the professional discipline as well, if you look at the history. That's why the nature of the sentence isn't even understood. That's not that complicated. But I gotta go.
Okay. Do you mind if I take a picture of us together?
Sure. I'll get my glasses back on so people know it's me.
You actually look remarkably like yourself.
Oh, yeah.
It has been enormously gracious of you to make time today.
What do you do now, aside from reading this?
I'm a author, a writer and editor of a variety of projects. Here we are.
Should I?
Take one of us together.
Yeah.
There we are.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Good. Sorry, I gotta rush you off.
No,
it's a busy day.
I've taken a lot of your time today already.
Good to see you.
Good to see you too.